Oh, there we go. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another one of our Monday streams. I'll just make sure I've got all the back-end stuff open that I need so I can track everyone's comments or donations as they come in. That's a good way to seamlessly segue into the normal shilling. We are still monetized, so you can send comments via Super Chat or you can use our Streamlabs link. It is in the video description and it is also the pinned comment in the chat. So if you want your questions read out, that is the best way to do it. Before we get too shilling, I will introduce my faithful co-host on the Monday because it is her show. This is still Evelyn's Corner.
Yeah, you are my co-host here.
I know, we're each other's co-host.
Okay, that'll do. I'll settle for that.
That's how it works, okay? We're co-hosts to each other. This is the truth.
That's fine by me. Well, I need you anyway for your specialized knowledge on the subject at hand.
Somewhat, yes. A lot of it is stuff that most people would probably guess is happening, but from my capacity and some of my experience in the construction industry, I can confirm that it is indeed happening on a very, very large scale. Although we've pieced together, I think, quite a compelling number of sources here, because what we're going to be talking about is social housing, and specifically the shell game that goes on with social housing.
It's a bit like the case of the rewilding stuff we looked at
Yes.
a little while back, where it's very easy on the face of it to be like, oh yes, of course it's a scam, but you don't realize how damaging and how far spreading that scam can really, sorry, how far the effect of that scam can proliferate with any form of society or economy or whatever's going on.
Yes, it's kind of amazing how intertwined this is and how deliberately hidden from the public it is. Because if the public knew what was really going on here, they would, of course, object to it. They don't want their neighborhood to be turned into essentially an infinite council estate.
Yes.
The title of this is not hyperbole. What is going on, as we'll show it with construction, mostly in London and beyond, is that we are seeing a huge, huge increase in the supply of what is considered mixed social housing, or what has been bundled into the euphemism now of affordable housing. Because when you see any talk of affordable housing, you must realize that affordable housing and social housing now has a very similar definition. The maximum rents that a council will pay will often be driven by what is considered the affordable housing threshold.
Yeah, it's almost an admittance that the only way to have any quote unquote affordable new houses is to build and distribute them through a socialized network.
This will also show you how incredibly locked down the planning process is. That all of this happens and all of this is done behind closed doors, because they pretend that it's being done on a case-by-case basis. But what you learn is, when you look at these documents, the requirements are the same, the specifications are the same, and what they're doing is they are essentially shutting out any purely private project, apart from a small handful of like elite buildings that are in these, essentially what the ministers and governments have almost designated as safe zones, because you will not see this in places like Westminster.
No.
You will not see this where the MPs
Well,
live, where they gather, and in the corridors between them.
there is a sort of funny, not a, maybe not funny coincidence, but of course Westminster exists just on the fringes of what is referred to as the City of London, where,
Yes.
weirdly enough, mayoral London policy, which seems to be a massive driver and where a lot of this affordable housing, as we will get into, is being pioneered. That policy then doesn't affect the actual central part of London where all the important people live, because they've shielded themselves from what the extra layer of democracy in London has allowed to happen. And that
Yes.
looking at that through the lens of any sort of democratic structure, it begins to become more obvious why such a phenomenon like this would continue on, and why democracy itself, again, is the mechanism for allowing it to perpetuate. As we have come up amongst us, I think, a number of examples now where these sort of local democratic fiefdoms,
yeah,
are entirely allowed to run roughshod over some region that only in a very small minority measure actually wishes to engage in the policy that's put upon them.
To give you a little bit of background, both in terms of my expertise and UK housing policy in general, because it's not a particularly well-known subject for most of the population deliberately, I have learned a lot of this knowledge through being either in or adjacent to the construction industry for the past 7 years about. And I've ended up quite heavily involved with the redevelopment of a lot of London flats and a lot of the new build flats as well. I'm quite privy to what their occupation is, how the refits are done, who is living where, and it's given me kind of a bird's eye view of a snapshot of how social housing now works in London. For those of you who don't know, we actually, on paper, live at a low point of what is direct social housing. What happened in the 1980s, during the Thatcher reforms, is in the early 80s was the high water mark. That was the high point of social housing. We'll see this repeated in one of the reports, but what it doesn't say is the ideas of social housing had failed. They had failed abjectly by the early 80s. And what we saw was the right to buy scheme.
Yes.
In that people were essentially allowed to use their rent for their council homes as a mortgage. Well, and a lot of this social housing was sold off.
Yes. Let's not just forget the fact that it might possibly be argued that the reason for the rent-to-buy scheme and what seems like, for once in its lifetime, a self-solving policy was actually a way to put lots of poorly built properties from the 50s and 60s in the hands of private owners so that the government was no longer responsible for maintaining properties that were essentially falling apart.
I mean, that is also true.
I would imagine if you were to look into a lot of the property that was bought up during the rent-to-buy scheme, I would be surprised if much of it was actually still standing in any way, shape or form.
Quite a lot of it is, because there was a lot of legal wrangling about that. But I don't want to get into that too much, but a lot of people were compensated for the value of their buildings if they were condemned.
But that's a lot easier for the government to go around and have to facilitate their previous existing social housing scheme that would have kept some massive block of flats fully populated.
It essentially functions as a buyout of the failed social housing policy.
Yes.
It functioned in both ways. It functioned on the surface of it as a noble, headline that they could say that they were selling people their own homes and giving people a way out of this social housing trap, which in some cases it did. Some of the especially council properties, especially in places like the north of England, are very well built. Mm. And they are extremely valuable homes now, extremely valuable family homes. But what also happened was that you ended up with whether it was a buyout of all this old property or not, you ended up with a low point of what is considered social housing after the 80s, going through to the late 90s. And what happens in the Blair years is you have a huge reform of the benefit system. And instead of the process by which if you needed a home, if you couldn't afford to pay your rent, you were put in a council house or you were put in a council flat, you were directly housed by the council. What the government brought in, what the Blair government brought in, was housing benefit.
Yes.
It allowed you to claim the value of your rent up until a certain amount, and it allowed you to be either housed in specialist, on paper private flats, or allowed you to keep your current flat until you were able to find employment if you were currently a tenant.
Hmm.
What this did is it actually massively increased the number of people who were effectively renting from the government.
Well, yes,
or effectively being subsidized by the government.
Yes, they moved, instead of the government, by the nature of social housing, having to ration out a limited number of houses over the space of a year or 24 months or however long. Instead, they are now just handing money to already existing private landlords who, of course, are now, have now got almost a free supply of tenants. You know, they no longer have to offer to someone a property that appreciates the actual value that they have to pay for it. Instead, yes, it's just the government's willing to pay for it, so who cares what the price really is at the end of the day?
A large amount of rental housing, though, I've rented a few times. I've only ever rented once as a primary home, but I tend to rent flats around the country to make sure I have proximity to where I'm working. And all the flats I've rented are no housing benefit, no DHS. You have to earn over a certain amount as a barrier to entry, not just to prove you can afford the flat, but because these are professional, you know, supposed to be in a professional environment with people who are of a certain quality.
I was going to say, someone in the chat, Miot Yori or whatever their name is, they said that the thing I noticed with a lot of these social renting areas is that people destroy their already shitty apartments and surroundings.
Yes.
This is the problem that you began to get. And this is how you ended up with what are referred to as the schemes in Scotland, which are housing schemes. Mm. And within those, because of the fact that that was the area designated for council housing, and that around the surrounding area around that was all of the the rental properties that those landlords, and generally those were bigger landlords, not private, you know, landlords that own one or two properties, you're talking about a bigger sort of holdings company, would then designate some section of housing next to that scheme for different council flats. And you end up with a complete separation, and you have essentially the creation of a sort of like council funded slum. And it would seem to me that this affordable housing scheme that we're going to get into and the new interpretation from 2021 to 2026, however long the policy is meant to go on for, it's almost an attempt to solve that and to take that block of social housing sort of populace and redistribute them amongst the rest of, in this case, London, so that it becomes less obvious that they live in a council-funded slum.
What this does is it takes these dire areas, even just the, we're getting to the more, you know, technical and egregious stuff later, but what the housing benefit scheme does, it allows anyone at any point in any place, you know, within a, you know, a certain value of property, it allows all low value property, even if it isn't a good area, to potentially become a council housing.
Mm.
For you to have people in there who have a quality in which they cannot look after themselves and have to be looked after by the government, and those people naturally are more destructive, they are more violent, they are less likely to be good members of a community. And usually what happens is, in areas, they self-select. You have areas that self-select for being family-orientated, being family-friendly. And it's not always an income indicator, as we've seen in some of the, as you see in the north of England, because it is a patchwork there. And the patchwork is areas with community and areas without community and areas that have essentially been Islamized. Or they have been turned into ghettos. Also, what this does is it also allows them to house refugees anywhere. Because if you can go to a landlord or you can go to a building company and say, we need to make, say, 2,000 units of affordable housing, and the local area, some of them have got wise to it now, but because it's not technically social housing, when the planning applications go through, it means they have a much easier time with local residents getting them to not protest these schemes as much, because these on paper are meant to be private homes. But in practice, because of what we see of the mixing of these two, they end up mostly as not. But yeah, we'll get into this, because this is a quick overview from something called urbanist architecture, it seems to be someone who's a master of architecture.
Just a bachelor's, actually. MSc, whatever that is, I suppose.
Yes. That's,
who cares? Nicole Aguilar, or whatever her name is. Write me a message. I'm sure I will. I do like they start at the right. The first thing you see in this article is like a lovely, new, cheery, red brick Barrett set of homes. Now, I can bet you for a fact, say for example, that house there, that's probably two or three quite sizable flats that are generally not used as council houses. I mean, that's I'm seeing, you know, ferns and grass, and this is not a council estate. This is not what affordable housing actually looks
No,
like in
these,
practice.
what you are seeing here is that is a semi-detached, a large semi-detached home on the end of it there. Those are flats. And those flats will be worth, depending on the area of this in the south of England, those are probably £180,000 flats. The home itself is probably worth about £400,000.
No.
What you are seeing there is possibly millions of pounds worth of property in that single picture. If and for the very reason that these estates are not mixed occupancy,
Yes.
and it, what that's not that's one of the very rare things we're not talking about is a lot of these new build estates are awful. They are traps for middle class people, but they are not what affordable housing is. This is
Yes.
not actually classed as affordable housing.
Is there anywhere specifically you wanted to start off in this article? I know there was a sentence I found earlier on that I found quite entertaining. It was that affordable social housing is housing that's been designed to build for rental to the council. Renting a property to the council benefits those on very low wages benefits or who are vulnerable, such as families in need of the help of the elderly, which is, again, just an admittance that, like, well, we've run out of ways to provide housing for the demand, so we're just going to incentivize private renters to give up houses to the council instead of private renters.
Yeah, it says it here. Affordable housing is housing that's designed to be easily accessible to anyone, no matter their age or pay. Social housing is solely council, although you can have affordable social housing where you own the property and rent the units out to the council for social housing. That's what's happening a lot here. Within affordable housing, there are two subcategories: affordable social and affordable market. Affordable social housing is housing that has been designed and built for rental to the council. Renting a property to the council benefits. Yeah, you've already read that bit. Affordable market housing is housing that has been designed and built in order to be rented or sold under affordable housing targets for young professionals or those on low income, kind of like a step up to the property ladder, as a much more affordable living situation. Within London, there is a specific plan. The London plan aims to provide. There's a page not available link, by the way. This link is dead, but we've got the link on another bit. Provides 60% of all the new build housing to be affordable, as well as an average of at least 17,000 affordable homes built per year. That's right, 60% of all new housing. This comment feels sarcastic, but it isn't. Amazing, isn't it? Our current mayor of London believes in equality of opportunity and therefore ensures that half of these properties are available to those who struggle to afford expensive living in London. It then basically goes on to say that the specification for affordable social and affordable market is the same. So essentially, what is being built here is that 60% of London's housing stock under this scheme will be able to be social housing. It meets the specification for social housing and can become, private social, as it were. This mixed, as we see in the WAF stuff, the
Yes,
mixed
a public
public and
private
private.
partnership. The thing
Yes.
I love about this is that, you know, this is someone with their master's degree. They've been studying for, you know, however long. Nicole is an urbanist architecturist, senior town planning expert, and a chartered member of the RTPI with over 10 years of town planning and urban design experience spent. Blah blah blah. She's been at this for 10 years, and she hasn't considered that if you drive up the demand for housing in a region, that makes it more expensive. And if you
Yes.
artificially drive up that demand further by subsidizing the building and the building and the subsistence within these homes, then you do that even more so.
We have a donation here from Tank Imperator, donating $5 Canadian, $5 Leaf Bucks. Says government money laundering through government policy causing massive poverty and ghettoisation. Say it isn't so.
Ugh. But just is how can you be involved in an industry like that for so long and not have at least some inkling into the fact that, oh, space is limited. Maybe we should consider that whilst we consider, you know, we constantly buy up the most expensive, scarce land in the most densely populated bit of Britain.
Well, what they're saying here is that, many social housing developments and early forms of affordable housing are leave much to be desired, as usually it looks very institutional. But the
Sorry,
issue is
which
that
part is this?
it's a bit lower. It says affordable versus, it's above where it says affordable
All
versus
right.
social housing. It has to move beyond. It's the what this waffles around, and what this talks about is the fact that affordable housing and social housing have been folded into being the same thing.
Yes.
But what it doesn't seem to realize is that a government specification for housing built by private firms to that specification is exactly what the scheme program was.
Mm.
The council set the specification, the government set the specification, but it doesn't have the expertise to build the damn things.
Yes, it's like it's the system built stuff in the 50s and 60s.
Mm. What this is exactly the same. What they're talking about here is, if you've seen it, all these interchangeable filing cabinets with this, you know, almost like wood grain cladding on it. These are going to look awful in 10 years. Some of them already look awful. And what they are creating here is, like I said, a situation in which potentially 60% of any development could become social housing at any time.
I'm just looking at it. New build social housing today is very different from these brutal properties of a bygone era. Many new build developers prefer to build their developments and rent out to the council to ensure the quality of living is greater to that of the previous standard. In many cases, the councils come to developers and ask for them to build. So ask for them to build affordable housing for all markets to regenerate their borough's housing stock. It's kind of weird there that you know, it's like, oh, we need another 5% of housing liquidity. How... Hold on for a second. You know, the whole thing here is some implicit economic plan of a heavily centralized nature is the only way that we will ever provide housing to people. You know, you can't just have people building houses because they want to, or they want to sell them on or anything like that. That's way too simplistic and barbaric. We can't live like that in modern Britain.
Here's the key. It says planning permission. Is it easy to get planning permission with affordable housing? This contradicts itself. It's really funny.
Mm.
It says the short answer is no. And then it says 100% affordable housing, on the other hand, can prove to be more successful. So the answer is actually yes, as long as you ensure a mixture of tenure. In many new build projects, the councils have put into force, this is the vital part, agreements and contracts for developers of specific sizes. This could potentially mean that you must rent a minimum of units to your council if you want to attain planning permission. That's vital because this is happening. This is happening ubiquitously. This is happening everywhere. It's happening in all developments. This is a requirement, especially in London, for basically every new development. You have to have a certain percentage, and I've heard that percentage is generally about 20%, which is very high for a tower block. If you have a tower block that is 20% social housing, is 20% essentially ghetto level residents, that will destroy your entire development. Again, we'll get into a bit more of it later. Keep us to know. What is the difference between affordable and social housing then? Affordable and social housing are different yet similar. Affordable housing is privately owned, social housing is blah, blah, blah. But what they're saying is that it doesn't matter because the specification is set by the government. And the government says that affordable housing and social housing are the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even understand the sentence here. 100% of affordable housing in particular, all of it, should have a good mixture of tenure as per the guidance of the local council or the London plan. I mean...
I know what that means.
I mean, I think I know what that means, but it's very much like wink, wink, nod, nod, good mixture of tenure, comrade.
Yes, basically. It is basically centrally planned, socially engineered housing. And this is not market-led. As we said, that it's the London plan says that 60% must be affordable housing. Which, like I said, it means that 60% of all new London properties meet the specification for being a council house.
The sentence before, generally, more affordable homes mean fewer people have to seek social housing or become homeless due to severe debt. So that's why they're building more housing that must be distributed through a socialised method. Because that will then stop people seeking socialised housing?
Like I said, what they're doing is they're redefining social housing. They're saying, look, at we're not building more social housing. We're building affordable housing, which just so happens to meet the specification for social housing. And by the way, the rents can't be more, because that's the way it's set, by the way. None of it says this, but I know this for a fact, because that's what's in parts of the specification, that the maximum rents and the maximum prices for what is considered affordable housing are the maximum rents and prices that a council will pay to turn it into social housing. The two specifications match each other identically. That's what it's designed for. And that's what I mean by the fact that it is completely, at any moment, all of this can become quote-unquote social housing proper. I get 60%. That's insane. And again, this is an admission by the government that they have no interest in market-led investment.
No.
They have no interest in the housing market stabilizing itself. Because as I won't patronize people here, I'm sure many people know that social housing and government provision of housing takes that housing out of the housing market.
Yes.
It makes the housing market more expensive. The more council tenants you have, the more people on housing benefit, the more mixed development you have, the more allocated housing that you have, the higher the price of private properties will be.
Well, this is why I mentioned the rewilding schemes. The more farmland that is rewilded and is rewilded by subsidized projects that don't have to consider the cost of arable land, as each hectare of arable land is rewilded by these projects, then there is less arable land to farm on. Now, first off, of course, that's an issue with food distribution. But second off, the cost of farmland then begins to increase dramatically, as you're seeing here the case with housing.
I'm trying to find, I've neglected to put a couple links into this because it's a little bit out of scope, but a little bit of background here. The next one I want to move on to is the London.gov Homes for London as Affordable Homes program.
Is this delivering on London's housing requirement interim report one, or?
No. It's the page that all of those PDFs came from. I'll put it in the Discord pretty quickly here. It's the latest link. But this is basically the top end, because we're gonna, to actually prove this, to actually show the details of this, you have to basically play a shell game, because all of the details of these schemes and their requirements and the requirements of developers are hidden. They're hidden behind all these different reports. If you go into the Homes for London's Affordable Programme 2021 to 2026, this is the latest of several programmes. We went over it, I think, on a previous stream when we talked about the fact that in terms of building, that the government has already put in $7 billion nationwide for new building schemes. And London alone has secured $4 billion extra, I think. The mayor has secured $4 billion from government to deliver affordable homes in London under the new Homes for Londoners program. Which
I do find it rather funny that this is, of course, mayor of London, London Assembly thing. So of course they're going to suck Sadiq Khan's arse. But that previous article, it was almost attributed to, you know, this is a stroke of Sadiq Khan's unique genius to engage in this scheme.
It's basically, again, this is all a shell game. It's all government money. What is being built, as you'll see, at East London, everything east of Canary Wharf looks like a Chinese ghost city.
Yes.
I've been there during the day and it is disturbing. You have, it's like the unconstructed space in Inception. You have these half-finished identical units that if you look, they give you a weird like parallel effect because they're identical, they're on the same plane, and they just look bizarre. They'd like do something to your brain.
I mean, when we were looking at this yesterday, sort of before, or sort of thinking, the first thing, you know, you've got your funding agreements, local authority stuff, all these PDFs, some of which we'll get into in a moment. Yeah. But the first thing is equality impact assessment. And then you've got a 28-page PDF about how all housing policy must, you know, it's not even to the level of, oh, well, it has to reach this goal. It's now almost coming, again, I use the phrase Maoism sort of offhandedly, but, you know, it's no longer that that housing policy must reach egalitarian goals, it's that all housing policy must always be reflected and developed through these sort of visions of equality.
Well, this, once you look at this PDF, when you look at this requirement, remember that £4 billion of taxpayer money and 60% of London's housing stock going forward must meet these requirements. It must meet this equality impact assessment.
Well, yeah, I mean,
when you look at these,
to quickly go on to the grant agreement thing, which is an 80-page document, mind. I will quickly find the section in here. I think it was page 60 something. It's health and safety stuff, construction identity. Where is it? Yeah, they have pages and pages of stuff. If I can find it, I seem to have lost it.
You just gotta write page numbers down.
I know it has the page number thing, but just the PDF doesn't line up. Intellectual property. Yeah, here we go. Equality, diversity, and inclusion. Within 12 yeah. months from the notification of the grants recipient's funding allocation for AHP, the grant recipient must comply and therefore continue to comply with the 5 minimum equality, diversity, and inclusion standards found in the following, you know, London.gov website, and develop, publish, implement on a continuing basis an equality, diversity, and inclusion plan which complies with the guidance found in the following website. So it's not only that you've got to build houses for the migrants, you've got to make sure that the way in which you build the houses for the migrants also appeases the migrants.
And it's that, not only that, it's that the construction companies themselves must have their own diversity and equality plans for how they operate.
Because
this is where all this is coming from.
Because otherwise you won't be able to afford to build housing in London.
Well, it's not even that, it's you won't get planning permission.
But even just looking at this in terms of grants, before we get into the rigmarole of planning, which is a whole other big issue.
Yeah.
You know, it is de facto law now that if you want to build housing in what is left of the competitive parts of the housing market in London, you have to comply by this.
Yes, you do. And you have to, even if you're making a very, very upmarket settlement, if you're making a very, very upmarket building, you might have to appease the council by putting a building next to it or having part of your development scheme, because I know this happens, and that they'll build a tower block of premium housing, then they'll have to essentially build a tower block of social housing to appease the council.
Yes.
You can't do one without the other. And that's where you get your 60% from. You'll maybe have, say, 200 units of premium housing. I'm working on one currently. It has a sauna, a cinema. It's a purely premium project.
Mm.
But the company, I think, is also having to undertake a social housing project of more units to offset that and get the planning permission for it.
Yes, it's a bit like the way car manufacturers work nowadays. You know, you can build... BMW has to build so many hybrids before they are granted enough carbon credits to build an M3 or an M5 or whatever.
Well, let's...
is there anything
quickly
in this?
Look,
yeah.
Let's quickly look at the contents of the Equality Impact Assessment and look at just the headlines here. Because it informs every single piece of housing policy in London, it seems. You have to meet this scheme, and it is pervasive. It goes into everything. It talks about the public sector equality duty. It talks about the Equalities Act of 2010. General housing baseline data, housing affordability, housing tenure, housing need. Again, there's that word, housing tenure. It talks about the equality impacts of funding conditions, equality impacts of funding conditions imposed by the government. Equity, diversity, equality, diversity, and inclusion, sustainability standards.
I have to go and see what the equality, diversity, and inclusion section. Oh God, I've already seen LGBT, BAME, young.
When it talks about general housing data, this document uses the phrase BAME.
Yes.
Which, for those of you who don't know. Is a acronym of Black, Asian, and Minority Ethnic, used to basically refer to as the non-white soup in Britain.
Yep.
Londoners from black, Asian, and ethnic minority backgrounds are more likely to live in poverty than those from a white background. 39% of BAME Londoners live in relative poverty after housing costs, compared to 25% of white Londoners. Insofar as those with some religious belief, Buddhists, Hindus, Sikhs, and particularly Muslims, are more heavily represented among London's BAME population, they too are more likely to live in poverty. It goes into all of this. Like, how is this? Yeah, the Centre for London recently reported that LGBTQ plus Londoners are more social economically polarized. Basically, they're either an overclass or an underclass.
Yeah,
because they've been brought into the technological structure.
They are either like rich people's kids running around trying to be special, or like homeless, like rent boys or something. There is no in between ground. To be eligible for grant funding through the programme, investment partners must commit to helping the mayor improve in quality. They've got to help the mayor specifically. It's not the London Assembly. It's not London itself. You are helping the mayor improve equality, diversity and inclusion, EDI, in London. All investment partners receiving funding through this programme will be required to meet minimum standards outlined in the mayor's good work standard. Standard diversity and recruitment pillar. Investment partners receiving funding will be required to develop, publish, and implement an EDI action plan, which includes at least one action from each of the following three themes: organisational equality, diversity and fairness, sustainable and diverse supply chains, and working together with London. Sustainable and diverse supply chains, that's almost an oxymoron.
It basically means that you have to, not only you'll be audited, but your suppliers will also be audited.
Yes.
That's what they're saying. It's just they don't think you can get around this by subcontracting it out to firms that aren't diverse enough, comrade.
Mm.
You have to go in and you have to hire companies. And if we don't like you, if we don't like what you're doing, we can at any moment use this to go in and fuck
these requirements are intended to promote increased diversity in the built environment sector and create a more equal, diverse and inclusive London by meaningfully enhancing organizational practices, procurement methods and engagement with communities. This is almost like pure like friend enemy stuff. That's them essentially wink wink nudge nudge, if you're not part of the ideological monopoly then get the fuck out.
Well, this means that if a building program that receives government subsidy is much more likely to be able to afford to be built than one does not. Mm. One that does not. A housing project that meets the Affordable Housing Act and also has a grant is even more likely to be developed. So what you see here is that they are not only picking winners, they are very, very clearly saying that build in London,
in architecture, women identify a culture of sexism and exclusion at work, especially in decision-making and networking opportunities. BAME architects experience discrimination, and LGBTQT plus architects report experience homophobic and transphobic slurs. So there's all the diversity hires getting bullied on the work sites by the folk that actually have to do a real job. Fucking get it right up them.
That's exactly what's happening. Coney Current Year says infinite London housing estate. What about the infinite new build estate? It's become the same thing, unfortunately.
Yes. Potential negative impacts. Oh, there's only one negative impact from equality, whilst there's dozens of positive. There is a risk that excessive requirements placed upon investment partners could negatively impact on the delivery of new homes and affordable homes, which would adversely impact groups most likely to benefit from these homes, including those groups with protected characteristics that are overrepresented in affordable housing. Which is, again, is an admittance of like, oh yeah, if this plan goes sideways and we basically make the construction of homes an unprofitable enterprise, then all the people who would otherwise be in social housing will be homeless.
Streamlabs is indeed still working, James Murray, yes. I'm getting to donations in a second. I have had quite a few, so I will get to those in a few minutes. The Streamlabs link in might not be working. I'm sorry. That needs to be redone on your end, Evelyn, because I think I broke it last time. The Streamlabs pop-up is not currently working, but it will be next time. It's because that's usually on Trig's thing.
Mm.
And I think we redid it once, but it broke. So yeah, Streamlabs is currently broken, and I forgot to fix it. So sorry about that, James Murray. I did see your donation though on the back end.
Mm.
He said, conceding the identical new builds, have you heard of the street corner sickness? That is the residents of the brutalist utopia Brasilias suffer from. Without any nooks or crannies of a rules natural city, they feel alienated and alone without community. Yeah, that's the
life of living in the close from Clockwork Orange.
It is, yes. But he mentions Brazil there as well, which is a good example.
Mm.
And yeah, it is. It's like a sickness of the mind. It's also, we'll get into it in a few minutes, because there's a couple more things I want to cover before we get into the social engineering aspects of this.
Yes.
But the diversity, like I said, this document has 28 pages, including a front cover and a bunch of waffle in it. And it mentions the term BAME 36 times.
God, they've even got a thing here for gender reassignment.
Yep. Basically, to get access to the money faucet and get planning permission, you have to prove you're making homes for immigrants. That is the long and short of this.
I just love the language. It's so of... I mean, I think it's because this is slightly more technical. Like, this is the stuff the actual policy wonks read and take seriously, and when they read a sentence like black and minority ethnic groups are more likely to experience poverty, they're more likely
to experience it.
It's if you're a white person, you're just poor, but if you're black, you're experiencing the spiritual, you know, existential crisis that is poverty, but if you're white, you're just poor.
Yes, that is the long and short of it. That you, this is not like, there's not an idea that poverty is anyone's fault. There's not an idea that being on a low income.
I don't even think you mentioned specifically low income people in this, do they?
No, they don't.
Look, that's kind of, they've managed to talk about social housing without specifying that social housing is for people of a low income. It's actually just for brown and black people who also just happen to be low income.
Well, the term income is mentioned 26 times in this, but mostly in relation to the fact that brown people are more likely to be low income. There's a housing affordability section. That's kind of it.
Mm.
There's a lot of footnotes about it, where they've got their information from. In the text of the document, it's actually mentioned less. That's what we're at here. A sustainability and equality document here mentions the term income less than the term BAME. And that should tell you everything you need to know about how this is being apportioned.
Mm. Any part you want to move on to next specifically?
I want to have a very quick look at, there's another PDF here. I think you mentioned it earlier, there's the PDF where they talk about specifically that they have to undertake this framework.
Is this delivering on London's housing requirement one or the grant agreement one?
I think it's the one you read previously, a little bit of.
Ah, yes, I just grabbed the page in it. It's like the 82 page long one that's part of all the requirements you must meet to even get verified and continue to receive one of these grants.
Well, before we move on to the social engineering stuff, we should go into the, because we don't have a huge amount of time, let's go into the demographics, I think.
Well, I think, yeah, there is an interesting thing about London, actually. We discussed this again yesterday a little bit. That London is unique insofar as the fact that it is a conservative non-white fiefdom.
Well, London largely votes Labour.
Yes, but in the mayoral election, the majority voted for Sadiq Khan, who is ostensibly a member of the Conservative Party, is he not?
No, he's Labour. Staunch Labour.
Have I got myself?
Yeah, he's always been Labour. Yeah, Sadiq Khan's of course he's Labour.
I don't know how. Never mind. I'll shut up.
He is essentially, he's like a Diane Abbott figure. He's their guy. He is the, you know, the BAME of the BAME. That's why he comes out with this stuff. But no, it's, I think what you're trying to say is that they went seamlessly from a Boris Johnson figure
Yes,
to a
sorry.
Sadiq Khan figure without blinking. I think you meant to mention Boris Johnson there. Because Boris Johnson was the mayor of London for about a decade.
Yes, but it's just that you can overlay population demographic map with voting demographic map, and then there the divides. Oh, sorry, I'm making a complete mess of that. The divides are almost, the map one over the other.
Yes, one is exactly, it is one for one, that what you have in these areas is you have the Labour areas and the non-Labour areas, which follow ethnic lines identically. Essentially, what you have in London between the Labour and the Conservative Party is the white and the non-white party. And the non-white party is now the majority because non-whites are now the majority in London. The majority of people who live in London. I think it's they say, oh, 60% were still born in London. It's like, yeah, that doesn't make them British.
Yes.
So 40% of people in London were not born there, or were not even born in the UK, I think. It is a ridiculously high number. It's again, the Conservative Party has paid lip service to it. There's William Hague talked about London as a foreign land. And then went on to cover up a whole bunch of the Labour government stuff. There's a lot of other things that have gone on to make London the way it is. But what we need to talk about is the fact that when they are saying this, when they come out with these reports, when they come out with this stuff that is, you know, it's buried, but when you find it, it's very mask off. They are talking to their audience here. They are
Yes.
winking and nodding and saying, we have got 4 billion pounds, and 60% of it is specifically going to house all of you people, all of my constituents.
Yeah.
It becomes a self-driving engine, and very much in the Hoppian sense, these people have voted to enrich themselves.
Oh, almost precisely. Yeah, that 2.4 billion pounds that is exclusively being spent on social housing as a direct product of the fact that London has a system whereby it can vote for itself and vote for extra privileges out of, or extra to the already existing Westminster policy. I mean, it's the same problems you find in Scotland, and it's why when they took on some social housing policy through elements of devolution in the 90s, that it went sideways and people ended up living in worse situations than they did during the bloody turn of the century.
Well, I want to talk about this because when you get into these areas and you get this mixed housing, what it happens is you end up with expensive private units that subsidize the social housing. That is what's going on here. The reality is, reality from what I've seen is when you get into social housing, because I'm involved in some of the refits with a lot of these council blocks, and we had a project manager there, and he had to step over human shit in the stairway. There were people who were pissing in the corridors. Four of the units, I think, were not like materially physically safe to go in. Another four of the units needed to be environmentally cleaned before they were able to be worked on. Three of the units had people in them who had to be sectioned when they came into contact with workers. There were two police raids, and I think one unit was actually found to be an illegal sublet as well,
Well,
which is a lot more common than you'd
we
think.
don't quite have the stuff here to point to because it's an investigation all of its own, really.
Yes.
But what in part is happening here is that private NGOs are not necessarily undercutting, but are being given the opportunity by councils to undercut and buy out large swathes of this social housing so that they can meet their 20% quota even easier. And no longer do they have to allocate these houses to people who have been on, some council house waiting list since the mid 2000s because they live in
Yes,
some dilapidated flat. Instead, what they
there's
do
a
is they just
not.
move the first family they find from a refugee centre in.
Yes, there is also a nod to it in the funding agreement section of the Mayor of London website they went over. It says that funding agreements for local authorities and registered providers, not for profit and for project, Profit were published on 12th of November 2021. They're talking about registered providers here, which is a hint that that $4 billion, both for profit and non-profit, is going to these housing associations and these unquote registered providers. This is a $4 billion social housing project under the guise of affordable housing. That is the language it used there. But I went to talk about a couple of specific anecdotes that I heard about. People are right that these units will be ruined, but a lot of these time, these units are worth in excess of £500,000 each, market value, supposedly. That's an inflated market value with the supply being as limited as it is, but that is still supposedly the market value. And I've heard stories about multiple families, it's happened multiple times, digging up the floor in their units and creating either ovens or fire pits or kind of traditional outdoor living. Like, they, a lot of these people aren't adapted to live indoors. It's like a step beyond being a street.
I mean, that's not their fault. They just never lived in a house before, and it's like one of those things that we always come back around to. It's, you know, it's almost a burden upon these people to force them to live in, like, you know, say for example, sorry, I'll bring it back up the article because it's but like one of these, you know, very generic crap balconied flats where everyone's very stuffed in together. You know, you're taking people who have lived in a region of the world that might have nothing whatsoever, no buildings at all that are anywhere near 6 stories tall, and then you're making them all live together in there. I mean, of course it's going to go wrong.
There's a huge thing as well in that a lot of these projects have large viability problems. So, like I said, they will sell to the private investors, and then they will essentially collapse. They'll go into administration, and then the council will take over your building.
Yes.
This has happened. I heard an anecdote from somebody who'd paid $1.5 million. I think it was in 2007, actually, for a penthouse flat in London, and 3 years later. I got this secondhand, but it's someone I know quite well. 3 years later, he said that he couldn't sell his flat because the area was so dangerous. He couldn't go in the lift in his complex. He'd been stabbed outside of the front door. He was afraid to leave his house. And a lot of these people are like that. The private renters or the actual housed families in most of these buildings are the majority, but it only takes a very small percentage. Even just, you know, one or two units full of incredibly violent criminals to create a housing situation that is intolerable. And what they are doing is, by diluting this, their idea is that we can't have these housing ghettos anymore. We can't have these schemes anymore because they failed. They're terrible. Everybody hates them. Nobody wants them near them. Nobody wants to live in them. So their idea is we're going to turn 20% of London into social housing and dilute it and hope that that solves the problem. But all that will do is create a mass scale council estate in which 10 to 20% of people in your building are going to try and kill you.
This reminds me of a little bit of Burnham, actually. There's a section in Suicide of the West where he talks about the liberal tendency to hate the idea of a skid row. Yeah. And he's sort of coming to this notion that, like, well, you know, all the poor people in New York and all the junkies and whoever else and the alcoholics and whatever, if they all end up in one corner of the city, it's not necessarily nice to have them there, but at least you know where they are. And they're all around their own type. So once you take all those people, and he makes this point, you know, if you try and displace them amongst New York, as the example he took, you just make it worse for everyone else, as we're discussing here. But I just find it kind of interesting. He picks on this sort of liberal notion that can't accept the idea that some subset of people, despite the fact that they live in the same city as another subset of people, would live in a lower standard of housing. So instead, you know, they must create a lowest common denominator for everyone instead of actually having diverse housing solutions. I mean, maybe living in Skid Row works for some people.
Yeah.
And that once you take away Skid Row and how cheap the rent was in this abstract Skid Row, that then actually life becomes more difficult for the very people you're supposedly trying to help.
It reminds me of the project in The Wire with Hamsterdam.
Yeah.
Where he essentially says, right, this area of the city is already dead. I'm going to funnel all the drug dealers here, and we're going to funnel, basically, we're going to funnel the social workers in there. We're going to funnel all these people in there, and we're going to have, like, essentially, we're going to create an abscess in the city to contain the infection.
And it ends up kind of working, and, like, too well.
Yeah. Yeah. He creates this nightmare zone. But it's the nightmare that people, you know, choose to live in because they're junkies. And you can surround it. You can stop the crime getting out of it. He's essentially going like, right, what we do is we put all the niggas in Detroit and we wall them. We put a big wall, around them. And we tell them it's Liberia, right?
Yeah, the Great Wall of Detroit.
We'll tell them it's their homeland. We've given them their own land. And then we're going to leave. We're just going to go over. He basically does that. And it's really, really funny. Because, you know, it does ostensibly, it's a fictional, obviously it's a piece of fiction, but it does ostensibly work for him. We have another donation from, oh, this is a great name, IPA is Global Homo Juice.
Yes, I endorse that. I endorse that handle.
Thank you, Mr. IPA. Says, come on, guys, you need to freeze in winter by being forced to install inefficient, unreliable, expensive heat pumps in your home to protect the environment. Also, estates will be put on every greenbelt field we can, you know, to protect the environment.
Yeah, it's like Colonel Creon below that. You can't be low income if you're making thousands in child benefit. Yep.
Yes.
It's just that I think that's what we call transitory poverty.
Yes. It's a, like I said, a huge, huge tale. When it came to Grenfell Tower, was the fact that a lot of the registered residents didn't actually live there. This was largely hushed up, but a lot of Grenfell Tower was illegal subletting. A lot of council and social housing and assisted housing in London is illegally sublet.
I'm trying to remember that, was there not headlines at one point where it was like, you know, appeal gives open opportunity for Grenfell victims to come forward. And two or three times the total number of people who were supposed to be living in the building came forward.
Yes. There was a huge amount of fake Grenfell survivors as well, which didn't help the matter. But it's basically impossible to enforce a false market. The grey or black market will always find a way to attempt to normalise things. Yep. That's why all of this subletting exists. And it's a huge untalked about problem. Within the housing sector, that an attempt to enforce quote-unquote affordable housing and the removal of supply benefits people who are willing to work, surprise, surprise, to work outside the system. You essentially end up with, like I said, black market housing, because it's the only way that some people can get housing, because not everyone is able or willing to engage with the system to a degree in which they will essentially be given one of these homes.
Someone in chat's got the right idea. Rewild the cities. Spot on.
Yes. Yes, forcibly.
Well, I think as Morgoth puts it, we'll be herding goats in Wembley Stadium.
That makes me want to recite the little speech from Fight Club with Tyler Durden. Talking about climbing the rhystic vines that wrap around the Sears Tower. You'll wear leather clothes at last your entire life, and you'll look down and see tiny figures pounding corn on some abandoned
superhighway.
it's incredibly Ted Pill.
Yeah, I do want to come back to IPA's Global Homo Juice's point, though. We'll get the last sort of half hour here. All of this, of course, this affordable housing models, all of this crap, is all connected to the World Economic Forum. It's all connected to the UN. It's all connected to, you know, sustainability programs, to, you know, whatever sort of language they want to use. I mean, what's the other one they're using now? It's the EGS, Economic, Government and Social Frameworks, and all this different technical nonsense. It's all tied up in the same thing.
Something very quickly to keep in the back of your mind with all of this is, in the UK, the government is legally obligated to house you. Like, by law, they have to house you, either in a bed and breakfast or in social housing or in a private. They are legally obliged to house you. You in the UK legally cannot be left on the street. So I don't want to go into this too much here, because I want to do a whole stream about the homeless industrial complex and the lie of homelessness, essentially, in the UK. Yes. But yeah, the government is legally obligated to house you if you can't house yourself in the UK, and that's where all this crisis is coming from. That's why they need to essentially nationalize 60% of London's housing, or at least make it meet the specification where it could be nationalized overnight. Sorry, you go into what you were talking about there.
Sorry, I was looking through. I mean,
Yeah, ESG.
there was sorry, it's ESG, not EGS, as someone has said. But I mean, the thing I wanted to really take out of this document is this 20-minute neighborhood plan thing, because I think that's just it encapsulates the whole mindset almost perfectly, insofar as that, housing is now intertwined through, not just on the level of the London Mayoral Board, who are ultimately facilitating this policy, or the same style of policy, but that on the grander global scale, it is about providing, in the most technically proficient manner, housing solutions. The concept of you living in something that you appreciate as a home, as a place that you actually feel comfortable within, and provides the qualitative aspects of life, has nothing to do with any of these policies whatsoever, and that this
No.
is pure sort of quantitative reasoning.
I've had a bit of a revelation, but do you know what this is? The 20-minute neighborhood, the 50-minute neighborhood. It's a town.
Yes.
They're trying to
Reinvent the town because
it
they've
is the
killed it.
simulacrum of a town. It is a town without having towns because towns aren't viable in this model. But when we talked about earlier the housing policy of the 70s and the housing policy post-war in Britain, that was the destruction of the British town, the traditional British community. People were no longer allowed to live in their organic towns or organic settlements that had grown up over thousands of years, many of them, as trading posts, as charter towns, as market towns, as these places with cathedrals and old cities and walls and cottages and their various districts and guilds and butchers and grocers. That was all demolished by the managerial class, by the managerialists in the 1960s. You got the scheme, the supermarket. Their idea then was we build big, we build large, we build efficient, and we utilize economies of scale to make the human being live in a more efficient environment. And it failed miserably.
Yes.
They completely destroyed British community.
Well,
They completely destroyed.
they took what was the functioning model of a suburb, which
Yes.
where we live probably is a remarkably well existing example of that, despite the fact that it doesn't work. I mean,
No.
if the two or three stores around here don't have the things that you want, you need to get a taxi or a bus to not just the local shopping centre, because there's no travel links there. You have to get there by car. You then have to go further afield, so you're now travelling half an hour, 45 minutes. So that, that's what you mean by this is an attempt to fix all the issues of the city planning during the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s.
Yes, it is. It's very therapeutic state. They have created a problem, and now they are offering you a solution to it if you hand your life over to them.
Yes.
The 20-minute neighborhood, nowhere in this does it mention the fact that, this is going to happen through market investment.
Just I've
This is
noticed
going
the
to.
phrase ability to age in place. Now, that is normally something that we would pretty much take for granted that you would, or at least up until the 70s or the 60s, 70s at least, that you were born somewhere, lived somewhere, died there. And you did that because everything was provided for you there. And now it's like everything will be provided for you where you are, and you will age in place, because it's no longer
Yes.
the organic function of you living in a home. It is now the technical procedure of making you stay in a domicile for 70 or 80 years.
Again, these are the it's like the mulatto world. You have these mulatto communities, essentially. You have these places where nobody is from that are constructed, that are reconstructed into these 20-minute units. You essentially are living in a distributed, you're living in a flat apartment complex. Because this was the entire idea We've gone this far. We've been here for over an hour now, and I haven't used the B word, but this is what the brutalist developments were for.
Yes.
Cities in the sky, walkways in the sky, shops and barbers and units, and they would all would be connected by the superhighway of the car. The car was the thing of the future. So everyone, you know, would obviously, you'd have the underground parking, but people that didn't have a car, you'd have the shops there. You'd have the, you know, the they'd be little towns. They'd be towns in a building, and they'd be amazing. And everyone could, you know, live out their lives in these places, and you wouldn't need to leave your complex. You wouldn't need to leave your scheme, because everything would be there. And they just collapsed. It didn't work because the business wasn't organic. And that's what this is. It's essentially... It's trying to sell you a town, but it's putting you in a scheme.
Yeah.
It's putting you in an environmentally, hermetically sealed. If you look at a little picture here, it looks charming, but there's a lot of tower blocks there. It's mostly tower blocks with like, essentially municipal buildings in it.
Mm.
It's all mid-rise. And what you're getting is the rise of like the mid-rise block, these little units, and you see them in London now, these little block units that are all identical, and they all, you know, they already look miserable to me, but they're going to look so awful in 10 years' time. And they're selling people the same thing that failed in the 60s and the 70s and led to the, you know, housing disaster really in the early 80s. They're essentially selling people these manufactured government housing projects. That are these weird simulacrums of towns,
yeah.
Because they have destroyed the towns and they don't know what to do anymore because their previous solutions failed.
There is one of two options here. Either this plan is a cogent and coherent plan that will come to its fruition in the creation of suburban prisons, or it will completely fall through and lead to the complete and utter death of the small town and the growth of like mega cities. If not, cause the two things to happen at the same time, possibly.
Well, that's what this is. It's about creating these little 20-minute neighborhood blocks within the megacity, within the giant urban sprawl. You, like I said, if you live in a town, you don't need a 20-minute neighborhood because you already live in a town.
Mm.
If you live in a village, you already have a village. This is specifically meant to be about urbanization. It's specifically meant to be about the planned urban environment and creating this endless sprawl, so you can have these, like, if you were playing like a city builder game, these ready-made blocks you can drop in anywhere. And you see them in Europe, they have these ready-made like polystyrene towns they drop everywhere, and they are horrendous because they've been funneling refugees into them, and they've become these like soulless places that, again, nobody's from. Yeah. Nobody wants to be there.
I mean, the Scottish government tried some of this stuff with the housing that they built for all the athletes for the 2014 Commonwealth Games. The plan was then to turn all these thousands of homes that they built, hundreds of homes, however many it was, into, you know, a separate sort of housing scheme communities that had their own sports and recreation facilities, community gardens and shops and all this stuff, as they say. But all of these business that they moved into these regions went broke in the matter of months. So you ended up with all these people who either had to live on the fringe and compact themselves into one corner of this housing estate so that they could then travel to the next main street and go to the same shops that they were going to when they lived on an old tenement council flat half an hour up the road.
There's a very quick one here that we can talk about, which is the BBC article from, I think it's from like 2018.
I don't think I have that one handy.
I'll bring it to you right here. It's called, ominously, How Cities Trick You Into Better Behavior. It is, again, this is a pure social engineering article. Because we've talked about the fact that, well, I'll say it explicitly. What is implied here? That when you have such tight controls of planning, you have such tight requirements, when the government is controlling the specification, not only for housing, but for neighborhoods, every building is a government building.
Mm.
Like, from now on, every building in London will essentially be a government building. It will be one of these, you know, combination private-public schemes. There is no such thing as a private building endeavour in London anymore, outside of very few specific projects. All of it has to run through this filter and be exposed to these 15 different PDFs worth of checks before it can be given planning permission.
I've just noticed a specific word here. They're talking about this is some
Nudges.
Anna, Anna Damami pointing out a chaotic four-way junction. The balcony is Mumbai apartment. Cars have stopped, blocking the pedestrians crossing. Both pedestrian cars to turn it as the mover stuck. There's no need for two sets of signals at the same junction, he's pointed out. And people don't change faulty behavior despite awareness, as humans are not rational beings, so you need new theories to change people's behavior. And then, as I said, he gets further down, he's talking about, first to convince the government, you don't need to make people mindful to change their behavior, Damani says. Subconscious nudges through the environment also work. We call this behavioral design.
Essentially, that it's like we're going to turn cities into like architectural MK Ultra, which is again a brutalist idea.
It's all
The
just one massive, like, Stanford prison experiment.
yes, well, it's all one giant. Like I said, it's like again, it's like the brutalism of the 60s, where this started was in the late 30s, 40s, early 50s. A lot of material was put out there by architects about how you could use buildings to socially engineer people. But I've still got an article in the works about it because it's a lot to. I want to get some proper specific stuff because people mention these but don't source it properly, which annoys the heck out of me. And I want to source it properly and give people and say, look, this is what they tried to do in their own words. But the idea of brutalism was to make people feel like these small economic units. It was to dehumanize them and de-individualize them, and make them feel broken by the revolution. Like it is the physical manifestation of the revolution of mass and scale. And that's what the that and this article is like this, here's how that's a good thing.
I mean, it's the insights that Elul takes out of Lenin, and that, something like national media or a national newspaper and mass media in and of itself is a function of mass organization. You are first getting to the mass to affirm itself as a uniform mass by engaging in the act of all reading the same paper. So imagine what it
Yes.
does to your psyche to affirm yourself as part of the mass by all living in the same method of social housing.
Let me read you this section. It's the paragraph before that weird yelling face. But
I know, I
it
was about to
says,
get to that.
other two, it says, beyond India, other countries have also been quicker to embrace behavioral design at the government level. The UK, for instance, has a well-established and successful nudge unit, a public-private partnership. There's that phrase. The Behavioral Insights Team. Its projects include helping persuade people to pay tax on time, increasing organ donor numbers, and convincing students from low-income backgrounds to aim for top universities. Basically, they are the managerial social engineers out in the open. Meanwhile, in the US, the Obama administration created a similar unit, the Social and Behavioral Science Team, though it appears to have been mothballed by the Trump government. Thank you, Cheeto Hitler, extremely based. From helping people conserve electricity to suicide prevention,
That is very
increases.
the anti-anxiety helmets.
Yes, it's extremely anti-anxiety helmets. Subconscious nudges prove to be more efficient than the usual awareness campaigns that typically use logic to explain to people why they should or should not do something. It's like we can't explain this to people because they reject our framing. So we're just going to basically fuck with them until they do what we
We're just
want.
going to force it upon them and
Yeah.
then give them no measure or strategy to do anything else, and then say it's successful because they adopted to it.
Yeah, because Richard, he talks about Richard Thaler winning the Nobel
Oh
Prize
God,
in economics, but
Richard
sorry?
Thaler's a fucking prick.
Yeah. He is the one who developed nudge theory, which is basically it's like what's the PR guy called? The guy who invented PR, sorry.
Yes, it's a very much Edward Bernays
Bernays.
situation.
Yeah. It's a but further Bernaysifying of economics. It's saying that the homo economicus can't just be left to his devices, even if he's been dehumanized. You have to constantly poke him with a stick to do what you want.
That's good.
Lesai donated £5 and said, "London is mentally exhausting. I'm surrounded by people who hate me, both foreign and native. It'll be a cyberpunk mega city, but somehow less interesting." Well, it already is. It already is a boring dystopia.
No, it's very much something I'm thinking about more holistically as I read through Elul, is to understand how there are, we think about these things as, it's a conspiracy theory that the World Economic Forum is working with Sadiq Khan to sell houses to NGOs. Now that for all intents and purposes might and probably is true to some extent. However, them trying to just technically solve the problem of how do we provide housing for the influx of hundreds of thousands of immigrants we need to keep the pension budget going. That then you just end up with something that looks like the affordable housing scheme. And the equality stuff that is tacked on is essentially just a bit of ad hoc sort of, oh, well, of course we're going to appeal to humanism because that's what we're motivated by. Because they could never admit on that scale, and the way that they're slightly doing here in this article, that they need to first implement and engage in the policy and then normalize the public to that policy.
Yes, it is. We have decided what the good policy is. We will make you acclimatized to it, even if you hate it on a rational level. There's two paragraphs here, where it says the film successfully blah 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 reduced speeding. There's a two paragraphs behind that which are incredibly ominous. Says nudges and other uses of behavioral science to change behavior are supposed to be used in the best interests of the people whose behavior the nudges are trying to change. Says Francesca Gino, a behavioral scientist and professor at the Harvard Business School. Again, it becomes by whose definition? Like we are brainwashing you for your own benefit, and we get to decide what that is. That is such again, it's such a sovereign statement to be able to say that. That we it is used for the good of mankind. Okay, who defines what the good of mankind is?
Well, I funnily enough, again, there was a little section from Elul earlier on where he says, if you look at the magazines of the Soviet regime and the Life magazine of America, the greater good of humanity is defined as essentially the same thing. It's just the task of who is to grant that greatness is always it's always changed. Which is the, again, it's the point from Lenin. You have to look at who is implementing the technical solution behind the values that they are arguing for.
Well, the second paragraph is even more ominous. It says Dominic, of Final Mile seems to agree with her. Initially, his company helped brands like Unilever market more successfully using behavioral science, but soon enough, we realized that the science had more width than just helping sell soap. We eventually moved out of marketing and into tackling social problems, like open defecation and garbage the
Poo and
anti-street
Loo.
shitters. Poo and loo, yeah. Well, the poo and loo stuff aside, they basically said, look, we realize that we don't have to be confined to selling people soap. We can try and change their entire worldview.
God,
It's like, okay, I wish the most, like the whole thing that the leftists have about society is that all these people are just trying to sell you products. I wish they were that simple. I wish they were
I
just trying
actually
to sell
kind of
us
like
soap.
the example they've got here at the bottom because it almost perfectly describes what all of that sort of technically minded thinking is attempting to do. They're talking about Final Miles have been approached once again by the Indian government, this time to use behavioral science to prevent speeding on the Mumbai Pune Expressway. In the past, the firm successfully reduced speeding by 50%, blah 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 blah. Then Dominic's team painted sets of parallel white lines that ran across the road. The space between these lines narrowed, so they weren't parallel then, as a driver approached an accident-prone zone. The driver, fooled into thinking that the vehicle was accelerating, involuntarily reached for the brake, which is an admittance of we skewed the perception of reality for these people so that they would act in a way that they wouldn't otherwise act because we have deemed that better.
Yes. That we have utilized essentially a perception altering architecture to make people break. To make people slow down in these areas, and that seems, but it's like, oh well, why wouldn't you do that? It seems benign to people who don't understand how logic works. They don't understand how behavior works. They don't understand how humans work. But it's the idea that you have all these adding ups of altering a perception to achieve what is always sold as a laudable goal. But if people on the Mumbai Express want to crash and kill themselves, that's their business. And it's a breeding out of a lot of the risk taking that built the modern world.
As you add each component, the lines that come towards together, the transport required to make everything 20-minute cities, the subsidizing required to create local businesses that supply the things that the World Economic Forum has decided aren't a sustainable town. That each of these elements add up, and you end up with an incredibly totalitarian system that is completely devoid of any human quality. As I said, it is a function of pure quantitative thinking.
It is a purely systematized world. The problems that the systems are supposed to solve are many, 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 many kind of iterations back. Like we have now, we're trying to create the 20-minute city because we had the globalists create the shopping centers and the highways. We had all these people who went in and had all this theory about centralization, and that failed. So it's like, well, right, okay, we'll destroy the village. We have to build a simulacrum of the village, but we have to build a mega city because we have all these immigrants. And we have to house these people, and they have to be mid-rise blocks, but they can't look too brutal because people won't live in them. And that'll fail, and then it'll be the next thing, and the next thing. And sooner the system will not, it will represent a solution to a problem that is a problem caused by several problems back. And it will become harder and harder and harder enforced. That you have people who are being subjected to this will of this systematizing that, it doesn't make any internal sense because it's a solution to several different failed attempts at a solution. It's insanity. And it's, yeah, you're right. It removes the human from the equation, and it creates a situation in which you are. We've talked in Homo about Homo economicus in the past.
Well, it's also sort of more to the point that on some level you can no longer, with the current technological state of developments, adapt housing to human needs. So at
No.
some point, inversely, you must begin to adapt people to the housing that you can currently supply them.
What is not said about the 20-minute city is that this creates lockdown blocks. It creates bubbles in which people will be prevented from leaving. And the rationale will be you have everything you need within 20 minutes. Why should you be allowed to travel outside of that? That's selfish.
Well, that's you're using up excess carbon by doing that, don't you know?
Yes, that's carbon. This is a lot of this is carbon credit stuff, and people who travel between these 20-minute zones will be, again, the other aspect to this is social credit. How do you enforce these zones? Well, you have to social creditize. You have to systematize people's behavior to a greater degree. And the way of doing that, again, it's to what is implied but not said is that you will not be allowed to leave your 20-minute city. You will not be allowed to leave,
Because, well, otherwise,
Eco Block 12.
what would be the point of it as an aspect of positive policy? I mean, this isn't a. I think this is maybe where the other aspects of the public-private partnership come in. That the 20-minute city is given to us an idea as if we're being sold it. That's that nudge theory thing. The making sure that we are normalized to the idea as it arrives in front of us, and that we are adapted mentally to accepting it, so that we're sold it, despite the fact that it was just going to happen anyway.
Yes. It's this idea that this is a natural function of reality, therefore we need to force it into reality.
Because otherwise it wouldn't happen without us.
Yes, because otherwise, well, the other story is otherwise the villains, the capitalists, the right wingers, the Nazis would prevent this from happening.
Yeah, well,
But you're
if we didn't provide social housing for everyone, people who were homeless would turn into Hitler.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what's underwritten in here. Underwritten is the idea, the very real idea, that RCW said it's about maximizing profit, which is not correct at all, I'm afraid.
I mean,
this is not...
an argument can be made that systems like this operate for the purpose of value extraction, but that's not profit.
No, I would argue at this stage, from what I've seen, that systems like this exist to stop collapse. These are largely borderline desperation anti-collapse measures. Because as we've seen, the system is very rickety. It's very wobbly.
Yes.
And without the constant tightening of the noose, it collapses. It is unsustainable.
It's the sort of level of technical proficiency we saw during the kind of total state era we discussed in democratization. I mean, funnily enough, it's a big wider conversation I was having with other people, but like one of the problems I find with a lot of the admiration that the mid-century Germans get is that people admire them purely for technical proficiency, which is only a metric that the modern, again, quantitative man cares about. And a qualitative aspect, there are so many other issues that should be addressed. And in the same scope here, you know, the qualitative part is never, the qualitative part is never considered, because it can't. If you were to consider it, then the technical necessity of the situation would instantly smash whatever qualitative measure you were trying to engage with.
The very idea that the government needs to be ever more involved in housing policy, to the degree that every single planning application now becomes an exercise in meeting a social housing brief, should alarm people.
Mm.
It has been bad in the past. It was bad in the 1960s and 70s with the scheme construction, but they never meddled in the purely private market to the degree that they are doing now. The two were delineated at first. This is the complete smashing of the wall between them and the subsummation of the private market into the public framework.
Yes.
There is no longer a private construction market in Britain. Otherwise, people would build Georgian houses, family houses, with gardens and an off-street parking. And they wouldn't build barrack homes. They certainly wouldn't build tower blocks. People would spread out. They would disperse. And a lot of immigrants would probably just have to go home because there's no room for them. That is the reality being fought here, that if you look at the way human communities have lived and existed for hundreds of years, even when the technology to make skyscrapers existed, they have generally chosen what the managerialists would call inefficient dwellings.
Mm.
And there's it's a bigger subject than this. There's a lot of architectural sneer when you read modern architectural theory about how humans choose to live in inefficient housing conditions and how terrible it is. Because they want to live in a house with land. They don't want to be crammed in and hemmed into each other on top of each other. They don't want to live in cubes. Anyway, is there anything we need to shill or cover?
I think we've pretty much touched on everything we wanted to touch on. I think the only thing really that may need mention is that, of course, there is writing over on our
Substack
page, and hopefully, I mean, next week, my speech and your speech will probably be on there.
We haven't actually mentioned Nomos yet.
Well, I was going to mention that next. I'm thinking as well, possibly we could maybe ask the speakers if they'd be willing to put their speech up on the same place. I'm not too sure.
I will ask them,
otherwise,
yes.
We will, of course, provide a link to whatever version of it they produce. And that,
yes
Nomos is going to be, it's like 5-6 days away.
Yes, it is. We are in the week of Nomos now. Like, we will be meeting people for the... but then on the 25th, in 4 days,
yep.
In 5 days' time, on the Saturday the 26th, we do still have a couple of tickets left. It's less than, it's about 8, I think, left.
I think it's 5
maybe
or 6.
Less now. Yeah, it might be 5 or 6. But there are still tickets available if you want to go. Birmingham, 26th. I'm looking forward to seeing people there. It's gone off quite well now. We've had to limit the capacity a little bit, but it hasn't been disastrous. So thank you, everyone, for supporting us with that. I've just... double check the leaflets, and we will have little it's just a bifold leaflet, but a little bit of material to give people. It'll look a bit more professional this time. So but yes, it'll be nice seeing people. I see a couple of people in the chat saying they're going, so that's good to hear. But apart from that,
other thing I would like to mention is that for one reason or another, these streams seem to have picked up a bit more traction over the last few weeks. which I am more than thankful for, and I'm glad that more folk are showing up. And I keep seeing it in the chat at the start of the streams or the end of the streams, where people are like, you know, they will take either A's recommendation or someone else's recommendation and check out our streams, and they'll be like, wait, this stuff's really good. There's lots of coverage of things that otherwise haven't been touched by other people, so I'm glad people are discovering what we're doing. And it's very cringe to ask, but please share the stuff that we are doing around with people who you think would otherwise care. Because we're never going to have some channel where thousands and thousands of people are watching us live, but that dedicated core base of 100, however many people want to show up week in, week out. We are making this stuff for you, and we are more than happy to. So,
yes, I will actually do the standard YouTuber thing and say, look, liking, subscribing, and commenting does actually help. I hate the cringe there, but that's just the way it is.
Yes.
If you engage with the video, if you share it with people, if you like it, if you subscribe to the channel and make sure you're catching the rest of it, this will actually help us. It materially does. But it's so cringe when people do that.
Yep. I will also quickly throw in a link to the Telegram channel for those that don't otherwise follow it. Because
I've got
a feeling in short order that might be the only place you'll be able to find us other than this channel and Substack.
Anyway, thank you guys for joining us. Thank you for putting up with our occasional blatant shilling. I'm hoping to see the people who are going to be there at Nomos.
Yep.
And that's thank you for watching, and goodbye.
See you all next week at some point. Goodbye.